shaking his shoulder and saying urgently, "Get up and get out." It was just gray dawn, and the cabin was freezing cold, and there was the faint sound of horses on the road leading up to the house. "Get," Sarah said. "Whether it's home guard or raiders, we're both better off if you're not here." She ran to the back door and opened it. Inman jerked on the boots and took the mats from the mantel and rushed out. He went at a dead run to the line of trees and brush beyond the spring. He plunged in, and then, hidden from sight, he worked his way around until he found a thick stand of twisted laurel situated to give him a view of the front of the house. He crawled up in the darkness, pooled under the laurel, and sighted through a fork in a trunk to hide his face. The ground was frozen to a crunchy grit under him. He could see Sarah run barefoot across the frosted ground in her nightgown to the hog pen. She dropped the poles of the pen gate from their stanchions and tried to coax the hog out, but it would not rise. She walked into the muddy pen and kicked at the hog, and her feet, when she raised them, were black with mud and hog shit where she had broken through the frozen crust to the muck. The hog rose and began to walk, but it was so immense and low-slung that it could hardly step over the gate poles on the ground. It had just left the pen and begun to gain some momentum, with Sarah driving it toward the woods, when there was a call from down at the road. "Stop right there." Blue jackets. Inman saw three of them on sorry horses. They dismounted and came through the front gate. Two of them carried Springfield rifles in the crooks of their left arms. The muzzles were aimed half at the ground, but the men's fingers were inside the trigger guards. The other man held a Navy revolver, pointed up, as if he aimed to shoot down a high bird, but his eyes were aimed straight at Sarah. The man with the pistol went to her and told her to sit on the ground, and she did. The hog reclined on the ground beside her. The two with rifles climbed onto the porch and entered the house, one covering the other as he opened the door and stepped in. They were inside a while, and all that time the man with the pistol stood over Sarah without looking at her or speaking to her. From the house came sounds of clash and breakage. When the two inside reappeared, one of them carried the baby by a fold in its swaddling, as one would carry a satchel. It cried out, and Sarah half rose to go to it, and the man with the pistol shoved her back to the frozen ground. The three Federals convened in the yard, but Inman could not make out what they were saying over the sound of the baby and of Sarah pleading with them to give her the child. He could hear their accents, though, flat and quick as hammer blows, and they brought up in him the urge to strike back hard. He was, however, beyond reliable range for the Lamats, and even if he were not, he could think of no plan of attack that would result in anything but death for Sarah and the baby and himself. Then he could hear that they were asking her about money, where she had it hidden. That's their nourishment, Inman thought. Sarah said what could only have been the truth, that all she had of worldly goods was the little they could see. They asked again and again, and then they led her to the porch, and Pistol held her hands behind her, while one of the riflemen went to the horses and took straps that looked to be pieces of old plow line from a canvas saddlebag. Pistol tied her to a post with the straps and then just pointed a finger at the baby. One of the men unswaddled the baby and set it out on the frozen ground. Inman could hear the man with the pistol say, "We have all day," and then he could hear Sarah scream. The men sat on the porch edge and dangled their feet and talked among themselves. They made cigarettes and smoked them to spittled nubs. The two underlings went to the horses and came back with sabers, and they went about the yard prodding into the cold ground hoping to hit treasure. They went about it for some time, the baby screaming and Sarah pleading. Then the one with the pistol rose from his seat on the porch edge and walked to Sarah and stuck the barrel of his pistol to the fork of her legs and said, "You really don't have shit, do you?" The other two came and stood close by, watching. Inman began moving back through the woods to put the house between him and the porch, so that when he came at them, he could at least shoot one as he came around the corner before they saw him. It was a poor plan, but it was all he had, given the open ground he had to cross to get at them. He had no thought other than that he and the woman and the baby would likely all be killed, but he could see no other way out of this. Before he moved far, though, the men stepped away from Sarah. Inman stopped and watched, hoping for some advantageous realignment of forces. Pistol went to his horse and got a length of rope and walked over to the hog and tied onto its neck. One of the riflemen unhitched Sarah from the post, and the other went to the baby and hoisted it by an arm and thrust it out to her. They began chasing about the yard, gathering up chickens. They caught three hens and tied their legs with twine and hung them upside down behind their saddles. Sarah held the baby to her. When she saw Pistol leading the hog off, she yelled out, "That hog's all I've got. You take it, and you might as well knock both of us in the head and kill us now, for it will all come out the same." But the men mounted up and headed back down the road, Pistol leading the hog, which trotted along effortfully at the end of the rope. They turned a curve and were gone. Inman ran down to the porch and looked up at Sarah. He said, "Warm your baby up, and then build you a fire just as high as your head, and put on a cauldron of water to boil," and then he jogged off down the road. He trailed the Federals, sticking to the margins of the woods, and wondering what it was he intended to do. All he could hope was that something would present itself. They did not go long, about 2 or 3 miles, until they pulled off the road into a swale at the mouth to a ragged little cove. They went up it a ways and tied the hog to a locust sapling and set about building a fire close up to a rock ledge near a swift creek. Emin reckoned their aim was to camp there for the night and eat until they were full, even if this meant cutting the hams off the hog. Emin circled through the woods until he was above them, at the top of the ledge. He hid in the rocks and watched them wring the necks of 2 of the chickens and pluck and gut them and put them on spits of green limbs above the fire. They sat with their backs to the rock and watched the chickens cook. Inman could hear that they were talking of home, and it came out that the 2 were from Philadelphia, and the one with the pistol was from New York City. They spoke of how they missed home, and how they wished they were there, and Inman wished they were there too, for he was not anxious to do what he was about to try to do. He moved a fair way along the top of the ledge, going quiet and slow, until it declined into the common level of the ground. Near the edge of the rock outcropping, he found a shallow cave and stuck his head in to find that it went only 10 feet deep into the rock. It had long ago sheltered coon hunters or the like, for there was an old black fire ring at the mouth. The cave had also sheltered other men, even earlier on. Their signs were scribbled on the walls of the cave, odd angular marks from some lost pattern of writing. None alive now could look on it and tell Alpha from Zed. Other marks depicted beasts long departed from this earth, or never here, mere figment residents of brain pans long since empty as an old gourd. Inman left the cave and kept circling the ledge until he could approach the encampment walking downhill along the stream through the gorge. Just out of eyesight of the men, he found a big hemlock with low-growing limbs, and he climbed up about 10 feet into it and stood tall on the limb right up against the tree trunk, like he had seen long-eared owls do when they're laying up in the daytime and seeking to stay hid. 3 times he gobbled out the call of a wild turkey, and then he waited. He could hear the men talking, but he could not tell what they were saying. In just a minute, Pistol came easing along with the Navy revolver out in front of him. He walked right under the tree and stopped. Inman was looking down on his hat crown. Pistol stuck his revolver under his armpit and took the hat off and ran his hand through his hair. He was going bald at the back of his head. There was a white spot of scalp the size of a poker chip, and Inman took aim at it. He said, "Hey." Pistol looked up, and Inman shot down on him at such an angle that he missed the bald spot. The bullet entered at the shoulder near the neck and erupted from the stomach in a bright outpouring that resembled violent vomiting. The man fell to the ground as if the bones in his legs had suddenly liquefied. He tried to pull himself along the ground with his arms, but earth seemed to elude his grasp. He rolled and looked above him to see what make of predator had fallen on him with such weight. When their eyes met, Inman put 2 fingers to his hat brim in greeting, and then the man died in an attitude of deep confusion. "Did you hit it?" one of the riflemen called out from down the hill. After that, it was fairly simple. Inman descended from the tree and retraced his steps, making a quick flanking movement back up and around the long rock outcropping, so that this time he approached the camp coming up the creek. He stopped at a thicket of rhododendron and waited. The 2 riflemen by the fire called out to the dead man over and over, and Inman discovered that his name had been Eben. The men eventually gave up calling and took up their springfields and headed upstream to find him. Inman followed them, screened by trees, until they came upon Eben. They stood for a time at a distance from the partially disassembled body and talked over what they ought to do. In their voices it was clear that their true wish was to forget what lay before them and turn and go home, but they decided to do what Inman knew they would, go on upstream looking for the killer, which they could not imagine as having done other than fled. Inland followed behind, stalking them up the cove. They moved along among the big tight-spaced trees near the creek bank, fearful of straying far from it lest they lose their way. They were city boys, wary of woods, and thoughtful in the face of the killing they assumed they were getting ready to do. This was to them a trackless wilderness, and they entered it with great timidity, yet to Inman they seemed like men walking up a thoroughfare. They made show of looking for sign of the killer's passage, but anything short of a big, deep footprint in mud was lost on them. Inman drew nearer and nearer to them, and when he shot them with the lamats, he was so near he might have reached out and touched them at their collars with his hand. The first one took a bullet near the point where his spine met his skull, and the ball carried away most of his forehead on its path out. He fell, needless to say, in a heap. The other Inman caught half-turning at about the armpit. Mortal damage was not done, much to Inman's dismay. The man fell to his knees, gripping his rifle before him. "If you'd stayed home, this would not have come to pass," Inman said. The man tried to swing the long Springfield around to bear on Inman, but Inman shot out the man's chest at such close range that the muzzle flash set his jacket breast on fire. The Philadelphians had fallen not far from the cave, so Inman dragged them into it and sat them up together. He went back and got the Springfields and propped them against the wall beside the men, and then he walked down the gorge. Under the hemlock he found that the remaining hen had gotten free and had its head immersed in the broken open belly of Eben, the New Yorker. It pecked at the colorful flesh pulp of his exploded guts. Inman fished in the man's pockets for cigarette makings and then squatted on the ground and watched the hen work. He rolled a cigarette and smoked it down and rubbed out the fire of it on a boot heel. He was reminded of a sacred song, usually done counterpoint, but he hummed a little of it to himself and thought the words. They were these: "The fear of the grave is removed forever. When I die, I'll live again. My soul will rejoice by the crystal river. When I die, I'll live again. Hallelujah, I'll live again." Inman decided to view what was before him in this context. Next to the field in front of the sunken road at Fredericksburg, or the accumulated mess at the bottom of the crater, this was near nothing. At either place, he had probably killed any number of men more satisfactory in all their attributes than this Eben. Nevertheless, he figured this might be a story he would never tell. He rose and grabbed the chicken by the feet and pulled it from out the New Yorker and took it over to the creek and sloshed it in the water until it was white again. He tied its feet with a piece of the Federal's twine and set it on the ground. It twisted its head about and regarded the world through its black eyes with what struck Inman as a new level of interest and enthusiasm. He dragged the New Yorker by his feet to the cave and sat him up inside with his companions. The cave was little enough that the men sat almost in a circle. They looked stunned and perplexed, and in their demeanor they seemed like drunks about to play a hand of cards. From the expressions on their faces, death seemed to have settled in on them much like melancholy, a sinking of the spirits. Inman took a stick of charcoal from the old fire at the cave mouth and sketched on the cave wall depictions of Sarah's quilt beasts that had pursued him through the dream world of the night before. In all their angularity, they reminded him of how frail the human body is against all that is sharp and hard. His pictures fit in like near kin with the antique scratchings already put there by Cherokee or whatever kind of person came before them. Inman returned to the clearing and checked the horses and saw that they had army brands, which saddened him. He untacked them and made three trips to the cave, hauling the Federals' gear to rest with them, all but for one haversack. Into it he placed the two cooked chickens. He led the horses up the cove far beyond the cave and then shot them in the heads. It was not a happy thing to do, but marked as they were, there was no other way that would not threaten to fly back at him or Sarah. At the camp again, he put the live chickens into the haversack with the cooked chickens and slung it over his shoulder. He untied the hog and pulled at its rope, and then he left that place behind him. When he returned to the cabin, Sarah had a strong fire going in the yard. Over it, a black cauldron of water boiled up a cloud of steam into the crisp air. She had washed his clothes, and they were spread on bushes to dry. Inman tipped back his head to the sun and saw that it was yet morning, though it did not seem possible to him that it could still be such. They made an early lunch of the cooked chickens and set to work. Within 2 hours, the hog, killed, scalded, and scraped of its hair, was hanging pale from a big tree limb by a gambrel stick run through the tendons of its hind feet. Its various organs and fluids steamed in tubs on the ground. The girl was working at a lard tub. She held up a sheet of caul fat and looked through it as if it were a lace shawl, and then she wadded it up and put it in the tub for rendering. Inman partitioned up the carcass with a hatchet. He chopped down on both sides of the spine until the hog fell into two sides of meat, which he then further divided along the joints into the natural categories of pork. They worked into near dark, rendering all the fat into lard, washing out the intestines for chitlins, grinding and canning the trimmings and scraps into sausage, salting down the hams and middling meat, soaking the blood out of the head to ready it for making souse. They washed up and went inside, and Sarah began on supper while Inman snacked on a plate of cracklings that she had intended to add to the cornbread. Since they wouldn't keep, she cooked up a kind of stew of the liver and lights, spiced with much onion and hot pepper. They ate, and then stopped and rested, and then they ate again. After dinner, Sarah said, "I believe you'd look some better if you shaved down." "If you've got a razor, I'll give it a try," Inman said. She went to the trunk and dug around and came back with a razor and a heavy strop of oiled leather. She set them in Inman's lap. "That was John's, too," she said. She dippered enough water for a shave out of the water piggin into a black pot and set it to heat over the fire. When the water started steaming, she poured it into the small gourd basin. She lit a candle in a tin holder, and Inman carried all of it out and spread it on the washboard at the end of the porch. Inman stropped the razor and wet his beard. He held the razor up and took note of a brown smear of blood on the cuff of John's shirt. Man or hog won. He looked in the metal mirror, put the razor's edge to his face, and went to work in the flickery light of the candle flame. He had not gone beardless since the second year of the war, and he was mixed in his feelings about seeing what he looked like after all that time. He scraped at the hair until the razor dulled, and then he restropped. He did not like looking on himself long enough for shaving was one reason why he quit. That and the hardness of keeping track of a razor and making hot water during the past 2 years. Going bearded seemed one less thing to have to fail at. The job at hand took some time, but eventually his face was bared. The mirror had gone to rust in scattered brown patches, and as Inman regarded himself in it, his pale face appeared scabbed over with crusty wounds. The eyes that looked back had a slit and sidling quality that he did not remember, a pinched and hollow cast to the features that was more than just food hunger. What's looking out from there now is all different from her boy husband, Inman thought. Some killer visage lodged in the place where once young John looked out. What would be the reaction if you sat by a fire in winter and looked up to a black window and saw that face staring back, he wondered. What seizure or spasm would it set off? It was to Inman's credit, though, that he tried to believe such a face was not him in any true way, and that it could in time be altered for the better. When he went back in, Sarah smiled at him and said, "You look part human now." They sat and looked at the fire, and Sarah rocked the baby in her arms. It had a croupy cough. Inman figured there was little reason to expect it to come out the other side of winter alive. It fretted in Sarah's arms and would not sleep, and so she sang it a song. She sang as if shamed by her own sounds, by the way her life voiced itself aloud. As she began, it seemed that a blockage had set up in her throat, and so the chant that escaped her did so with much effort. The force of air from her chest needed somewhere to go, but finding the jaw set firm and jutted, and the mouth clenched against music, it took the far way out and reached expression in high nasal tones that hurt to hear in their loneliness. The singing carried shrill into the twilight, and its tones spoke of despair, resentment, an undertone of panic. Her singing against such resistance seemed to Inman about the bravest thing he had ever witnessed. It was like watching a bitter fight carried out to a costly draw. The sound of her was that of a woman of the previous century living on in the present, that old and weary. Sarah was such a child to sound that way. Had she been an old woman who long ago in her youth sang beautifully, one might have said that she had learned to use the diminished nature of her voice to maximum effect, that it was a lesson in how to live with damage, how to make peace with it, and use it for what it can do. But she was not an old woman. The effect was eerie, troubling. You'd have thought the baby would cry out in distress to hear its mother in such a state, but it did not. It fell asleep in her arms as to a lullaby. The words to the song, though, were no lullaby. They linked up to make a horrible story, a murder ballad called Fair Margaret and Sweet William. It was an old song, but Inman had not heard it before. The lines were these. I dreamed that my bower was full of red swine, and my bride-bed full of blood. When that one was done, she started in on Wayfaring Stranger, at first just humming it and tapping her foot. When she eventually pitched in singing, it bore little kin to music, but was more like some pinched declamation of spirit sickness, a squeal of barren lonesomeness, as pure and undiluted as the pain following a sharp blow to the nose. When she finished, there was a long silence, broken only by the sound of an owl calling in the dark woods. Fit conclusion to songs so burdened with themes of death and solitude, and carrying more than a hint of the specter world. Sarah's offering of such music might have seemed to give no hope of consolation, either to the baby or especially to Inman. How unlikely that such a severe gift might yield a reduction of sadness when it was itself so bleak. Yet such proved to be the case, for though they talked but little the rest of the evening, they sat side by side in front of the fire, tired from the business of living, content and resting and happy, and later they again lay in bed together. The next morning, before he set out onto the road, Inman ate the brains of the hog, parboiled, and scrambled up with an egg from the hen that had been eating on the raider from New York. A Satisfied Mind. Ada and Ruby spent much of the autumn working with apples. Apples had come in heavy, and had to be picked, peeled, sliced, and juiced. Pleasant, clean work out among the trees handling the fruit. The sky for much of the time was cloudless blue, the air dry. The light, even at midday, brittle and raking, so that by angle alone it told of the year's waning. In the mornings they went carrying ladders when the dew still stood in the orchard grass. They'd climb among the tree limbs to fill sacks with apples, the ladders swaying as the limbs they were propped against gave under their weight. When all the sacks were full, they would bring the horse and sled to the orchard, haul them in, empty them, and begin again. It was work that was just moderately tiring, and unlike the haying, produced only a peaceful, still picture in Ada's mind as she lay in bed at night. A red or yellow apple hanging from a drooping limb, behind it, deep blue sky, her hand palm up, reaching out to the apple but not touching it. For a long time, Ada and Ruby ate apples at every meal, fried and stewed and pied and sauced. They dried rings of them into little scraps of apple leather, which they stored in cloth bags and hung from the ceiling in the kitchen. One day they built a fire in the yard and made a black kettle of apple butter so big that when they stood over it and stirred the apple mash with spurtles, the scene put Ada in mind of the witches in Macbeth working at their brew. The apple butter had come out thick, the color of old harness from spice and brown sugar, and they sealed enough of it in crocks to eat on for a year. They pressed cider from rusty culls and fallen apples, and they fed the pomace to the hogs, for Ruby said it would make the meat sweet. The cider had hardened up enough by now to be worth something, and for that reason Ruby went out one afternoon on a trading mission. She had heard that an Adams man down the river had killed a beef, and she had gone off with 2 jugs of cider to see how much meat they might bring. She left Ada with 2 tasks. Burn the brush that had resulted from their earlier clearing a portion of the neglected lower field, and, using the method Ruby had taught her, split the 6 rounds of an old black oak log they had discovered already cut into lengths out in the tall grass at the field edge. It would be a good initiation into timber work, for they would soon need to go up on the mountain and cut a hickory or an oak, limb it, and let the horse drag it home with a J-grab to be sectioned and split. Ada had wondered if they had the strength for such work, but Ruby argued in detail that it did not necessarily require pure power, just pacing, patience, rhythm. Pull the saw and release. Wait for the one at the other end of the saw to draw it away and then pull again. Avoid binding up. The main thing, Ruby said, was not to get ahead of yourself. Go at a rhythm that could be sustained on and on. Do just as much as you could do and still be able to get up and do again tomorrow. no more and no less. Ada watched Ruby go down the road and decided to split the logs first and enjoy the fire in the cool of afternoon. She walked from the garden to the tool shed and got a maul and a wedge and carried them to the lower field and stamped out a circle in the waist-high grass around the oak logs to make working room. The logs lay on their sides and were better than 2 feet across the cut ends. The wood was gray, for they had been lying forgotten since the tree was felled 2 or 3 years earlier by the hired man. Ruby had warned that the dry logs would not want to split as easily as when fresh and wet. Ada upended the big cylinders of wood, feeling the way they clung to the ground, and when she got them upright she found shiny black stag beetles the size of her thumb burrowing in the rotting bark. She went at the job as Ruby had shown her, first examining the cut end for a likely crack, then working it with the wedge, moving slow, not straining, just lifting the 7-pound maul and letting it fall so that weight and gravity and the magic of angle combined to disassemble the log. She liked driving the wedge in halfway and then stopping to listen for the ripped cloth sound of the crack as it kept opening for several seconds after the blow. The work was calm, despite all the pounding. The stubborn coherence of the wood and the weight of the maul imposed a slow rhythm to the task. In not much over an hour, Ada had split everything but one difficult section where big limbs had once attached to the trunk and confused the grain. From each section she had split 8 good-sized pieces of firewood, and she reckoned there were 40 pieces lying in a jumble on the ground, ready to be hauled to the house and burned. She felt a great sense of accomplishment until she realized that the wood would only serve for 4, maybe 5 days of fire. She started to calculate the approximate number of pieces they would need for the whole winter, but she soon stopped, for the figure would be dauntingly high. Ada's dress was soaked through across the shoulders and back with sweat, and her hair was wet against her neck, so she went to the house and drank 2 dippers of water from the spring, and took off her hat and poured 2 more over her hair, and then twisted the water out of it. She wet her face and rubbed it with her hands, and then dried it on her dress sleeve. She went in and got her lap desk and notebook and came out to sit in the sun on the porch edge until she dried. Ada dipped her pen in ink and started a letter to her cousin Lucy in Charleston. For a time there was hardly a sound but the scritch of nib on paper as she wrote. "I suspect, were we to meet on Market Street, you would not know me. Nor, upon seeing the current want of delicacy in my aspect and costume, would you much care to. I'm at the moment sitting on my back stoop, writing this across my knees, my dress an old print shirtwaist soaked through with perspiration from splitting oak logs, and I've been wearing a straw chapeau coming apart at brim and crown so that it bristles every bit as much as the haystacks we long ago lodged in to await the conclusion of rainstorms. Do you remember? The fingers gripping the pen are dark as stirrup leathers, stained from shucking walnuts out of their stinking pulpy husks, and the nail of the forefinger is ragged as a hackard and wants filing. The silver bracelet with the dogwood blossoms cut in it stands out in bright contrast to the dark skin of my wrist. It is a day so autumnal that to write anything about it would be to engage in elegy. I am resting and waiting for the dress to dry before I turn my attention to burning a brush pile. I cannot begin to recount all such rough work that I have done in the time since Father died. It has changed me. It is amazing the physical alterations that can transpire in but a few months of labor. I am brown as a penny from being outdoors all day, and I am growing somewhat ropey through the wrists and forearms. In the glass I see a somewhat firmer face than previously, hollower under the cheekbones, and a new expression, I think, has sometimes come to occupy it. Working in the fields, there are brief times when I go totally without thought. Not one idea crosses my mind, though my senses are alert to all around me. Should a crow fly over, I mark it in all its details, but I do not seek analogy for its blackness. I know it is a type of nothing, not metaphoric, a thing unto itself, without comparison. I believe those moments to be the root of my new mane. You would not know it on me, for I suspect it is somehow akin to contentment. She scanned back over the letter and thought it odd and somewhat deceitful that she had not mentioned Ruby, leaving the impression that she was alone. Thinking to rectify the matter later, she put the letter unfinished inside the desk lid. She collected a pitchfork, some matches, a shawl, the third volume of Adam Bede, and a little straight chair with the legs sawn off short, and carried them down to the brush pile. She and Ruby had worked with scythes and brush hooks and bow saws most of a day the previous month, and had let the cut brush fall where it would. The mix of blackberry canes, tall grass, good-sized jack pines, and sumac had sunned for several weeks, spread on the ground, and was now fairly dry. Ada worked a while with the fork to draw the brush together, and when she was done the pile was as big as the corn crib, and the air was full of the sear odor of cut and withered foliage. She kicked up some duff and some doty sticks at the edge of the pile and set it afire. While it caught and burned, she pulled the short chair into range of its warmth, and sat to read Adam Bede, but the book did not go well. She could not keep her mind on it, for she had to rise often to head off outrunners of flame that strayed across the stubble of the field. She beat them out with the back of the fork. And then, when the fire burned down flat, she had to draw the pile together and heap it high again, each time with a narrower diameter. And as the afternoon grew old, the pile stood tall and conical in the field, flames rising from it like a miniature of a spewing volcano she had seen pictured in a book on South America. So she had work as an excuse for not focusing her thoughts on the page. But, too, she had long since grown impatient with Adam and Hetty and the rest, and would have quit the book but for the fact that she had paid so much for it. She wished all the people of the story to be more expansive, not so cramped by circumstance. What they needed was more scope, greater range. Go to the Indies, she directed them, or to the Andes. She marked her place with a yarrow stem and closed the book and set it in her lap. She wondered if literature might lose some of its interest when she reached an age or state of mind where her life was set on such a sure course that the things she read might stop seeming so powerfully like alternate directions for her being. A bull thistle stood beside her. She remembered working around it with the scythe out of admiration for the fist-sized purple bloom, but it was now dry and silver-white. She reached out and began picking apart the head. Her thinking was that since every tiny place in the world seemed to make a home for some creature, she would discover who the thistle-dwellers might be. Soon, down blew about in the breeze and caught in her smoky clothes and hair. She found but one fierce little crab-like thing no bigger than a pinhead, living solitary inside the dried blossom. It clutched to a thread of down with some of its hind legs and waved a minute pair of pincers before it in a way intended to be menacing. With a puff she blew away the luminous thistle down and nameless creature and watched as they caught an updraft and soared until they disappeared skyward as the souls of the dead are claimed to do. When she had first lit the fire and begun reading, the light had been bright and even, and the sky graded rather too evenly from horizon to zenith, white to blue, in the way Ada associated with landscape paintings of less than the highest quality. But now the seal of evening was on the wooded hillsides and on the pastures. The sky broke into bands and whirls of muted color until the entire west was like the marbled endpapers of her journal. Canada geese, veed and honking, flew over southward, looking for a place to stay the night. A breeze blew up and flapped the skirts of the scarecrow out in the garden. Waldo had gone to the gate by the barn. She was waiting and would soon bawl to have her bag stripped, so Ada left her chair and put the cow in her stall and milked. The air was still and damp, cooling with the fall of day, and when the cow turned her head to look back at the milking, her breath fogged and smelled like wet grass. Ada pulled at the tits and watched the milk come out, listening for the change in pitch as the pail filled. First a high sizzle against the side and bottom, then a lower drizzle. The skin of her fingers was dark against the pink tit skin. After Ada put the milk in the spring house, she returned to the field, where the fire still burned slowly, falling into ash. It would have been safe to leave it for the night, though Ada did not wish to. She wanted Ruby to come walking up the road and find her sooty, standing sentry over the afternoon's work. The air had a cold edge to it, and Ada drew her shawl around her. She reckoned it only a matter of days before the evenings would become too chill to sit out at sunset, even wrapped in a blanket. There was dew in the grass, and she stooped and took Adam Bede from where she had dropped it and wiped its faces against her skirts. She went and stirred the fire with a fork, and it threw sparks into the sky. At the edge of the field she collected downed hickory limbs and dried jack pine and pitched them on the fire, and it soon blazed up and heated a wider circle of air. Ada pulled her chair close and put her hands out to warm. She looked at the lines of mountain ridges, the variety in their darkness as they faded into the distance. She studied the sky to see when it would fall deep enough toward indigo that the beacons of two planets, Venus and another, which she reckoned must be Jupiter or Saturn, might first shine forth low in the west in preparation for the dizzy wheel and spin of the night sky. This evening she marked where the sun dove to the horizon, for over the weeks she had made a practice of noting its setting point on the ridge. She had watched it march southward as the days snuffed out earlier and earlier. Were she to decide fully to live here in Black Cove unto death, she believed she would erect towers on the ridge, marking the south and north points of the sun's annual swing. She owned the entire span of ridge where the sun set through the year, and that was a thing to savor. One had then just to mark the points in December and June, when the sun wrenched itself from its course and doubled back for another set of seasons. Though upon reflection, she decided a tower was not entirely needed, only clear some trees to notch the ridge at the turning point. It would be a great pleasure, year after year, to watch with anticipation as the sun drew nigh to the notch and then, on a specified day, fell into it, and then rose out of it and retraced its path. Over time, watching that happen again and again might make the years seem not such an awful linear progress, but instead a looping and a return. Keeping track of such a thing would place a person, would be a way of saying, you are here, in this one station, now. It would be an answer to the question, where am I? Ada sat by the fire long after sunset, waiting for Ruby. Venus and Saturn had shone out bright to the west and then fallen to the horizon, and the full moon had risen when Ada heard a stirring in the woods, footsteps in leaves, low voices. By instinct, she took the pitchfork from where it stood in the dirt and moved out of the firelight and watched. Forms moved at the edge of the field, and Ada backed farther into the dark and held the fork before her with the five sharp tines aimed toward the sounds of movement. Then she heard her name. "Hey, Miss Ada Monroe," a voice called softly. Both names were pronounced in the ways that her father had hated. He had never tired of setting people right on the matter. Broad initial A in Ada, accented second syllable in Monroe, he would say. But over the summer, Ada had given up trying to enforce her name against everyone's natural leaning, and she was learning to be the Ada Monroe that the voice called, long A, heavy Mon. "Who is it?" she said. "Us." Stavrod and a comrade walked out to be lit by the fire. Stavrod carried his fiddle and bow cradled in the crook of his left arm. The other man held a rough-cast banjo by the neck, poking it out before him as a man at a border crossing might present papers in validation of identity. Both of them squinted against the glare. "Miss Monroe," Stavrod called again, "it's just us." Ada walked nearer to them, billing a hand over her brow to block the light. "Ruby is not here," she said. "We're just generally visiting," Stavrod said, "if you don't mind the company." He and the other man put down their instruments, and Stavrod sat on the ground right beside her chair. Ada pulled it a comfortable distance from him and sat too. "Get us some more wood to liven up the fire," Stavrod said to the banjo man. Wordless, the man went into the dark edge of woods, and Ada could hear him picking up limbs and breaking them into burning lengths. Stavrod dug around beneath his coat and pulled out a pint pocket tickler full of brown liquor. The glass was dulled almost opaque with scratches and fingerprints. He unstoppered it and passed the mouth of it beneath his nose. He held the glass to the fire and looked at the light through the whiskey and then drank a delicate sip. He made a little whispery two-note whistle, high to low. "Too good for me, but I'll drink it anyway," he said. He took a long pull and then worked the stopper back in with his thumb and put the bottle away. "We haven't seen you in some time," Ada said. "Have you been well?" "Fair," he said. "Living on the mountain like an outlaw is no lark." Ada was put in mind of the story she'd heard the captive tell through the jail bars. She began recounting it to Stavrod as warning of what might lie in wait for outliers, but he knew it already. It had passed around the county several times, first as news, and then as yarn, and later as legend. "That Teague bunch is killers," Stavrod said. especially so when they've got numbers in their favor. The wood gatherer came back into the light and threw some broken limbs on the fire, and then made several trips into the trees for more wood, which he piled for later. When he was done, he sat on the ground beside Stavrod. The man said not a word, nor looked at Ada, but angled himself away from the fire so he could keep his eyes on Stavrod. "Who's your companion?" Ada asked. "He's a swanger boy or a pangle. Sometimes he says one, sometimes the other. Neither bunch will claim him, for he's simple-minded, but he's got the look of a pangle to me." The man had a big round head, which sat unbalanced on him, like God was being witty about making the insides of it so small. Though he was nearly 30, according to Stavrod, people still called him a boy because his thoughts would not wrap around the least puzzle. To him, the world had no order of succession, no causation, no precedent. Everything he saw was new-minted, and thus every day was a parade of wonders. He was a fat, soft thing, broad-assed, as if he had been raised on a diet of meal and fatback. He had titties like a sow that pushed out his shirt front and flapped when he walked. His pants were tucked into his boots and bloused out above them, and his tiny feet were hardly big enough to bear up his weight. His hair was the next thing to white, and his skin was grayish, so that overall he gave the impression of a china plate filled with biscuit and sawmill gravy. He had no talent in the world but his recently discovered ability to play the banjo, unless one counted as talent the fact that he was gentle and kind and looked on everything that passed before him with soft, wide eyes. Stavrod described how they had hooked up, and while he did, the boy paid not the least attention, did not seem to know or care that he was the topic of discussion. Pangle had been raised somewhat casually, was the way Stavrod told it. The general feeling was that he held no value, for he could not think right, nor could he be pressed into labor. Work him too hard, and he'd sit down. Whip him, and he'd take it without a flinch and still not move. He had, therefore, been set loose in early manhood, and had spent the time since wandering Cold Mountain. He came to know its every slit and chink. Ate what presented itself, with little discrimination between grubs and venison. Paid little heed to time of day, and during the brighter phases of the moon went largely nocturnal. In summer he slept on the beds of fragrant duff beneath hemlock and balsam, except in rains of some duration, when he sheltered under rock ledges. In winter he took instruction from toad and groundhog and bear. He denned up in a cave, scarcely moving during the cold months. When, with some surprise, Pangle discovered the outliers had taken up residence in his cave, he settled himself among them. He particularly attached himself to Stavrod, out of being lovesick for fiddle music. Stavrod was to him a man of deep lore, a wizard, a revelator. When Stavrod struck bow to fiddle strings, the Pangle boy sometimes tried to sing along, but he had a voice like blowing a duck call. After the others shouted him silent, he would get up and stomp out a dance of great mystery, ancient Celtic jerk and spasm, such as might have been performed after any number of defeats in battle against Roman and Jute, Saxon and Angle and Brit. The boy would fling around until he blossomed out in sweat beads, and then he would flop down on the flowery, tamped cave ground and follow the fiddling, his nose describing the music patterns in air like a man watching a fly hover. Stavrod would get a figure of notes going, and it would come round again and again, and after a time it would work a spell on Pangle's mind. Pangle liked that feeling he got from Stavrod's playing, and became a fool for the fiddle and for the fiddler. He began following Stavrod about, always with the devotion of a spaniel awaiting food. At night, in the outlier's cave on the mountain, he would lie awake until Stavrod fell asleep, and then he would crawl up and lie pressed against his bowed back. Stavrod would awake at dawn and beat the boy away to a comfortable distance with his hat. The boy would then sit by the fire on his hams and gaze at Stavrod as if at any minute a miracle might happen. Stavrod had come upon Pangle's banjo one day on a raid, a term the cave dwellers used to lend dignity to their recent habit of robbing any wealthy farmer against whom one of their number held a vague grudge. Some slight 10 years ago would serve as pretext. A man had cantered by and splashed you when you stood a foot in the muddy roadway, had brushed past you and bumped your arm coming out of a store without a word of apology, had hired you for a job of work and shorted you on pay, or had given orders to you in a tone that could be glossed to mean you were less than he, Any snub, slur, or taunt, however old, would do. Times might never be better configured to settle up. They descended on a Walker man's house. He was one of the county's few gentry, a leading slaveholder, and that fell afoul of the Cave Society, their general opinion having lately swung round to blame the owners of niggers for the war and its related troubles. As well, Walker had long been a high-handed bastard with all he considered his lessers, which, in his estimation, included most everybody. Punishment, the Cavers had decided, was in order. They had come down on the farm at nightfall and tied Walker and his wife to the stair rails and taken turns slapping Walker about the face. They'd gone through the outbuildings and collected all the food they could easily find, hams and middle meat, quantities of crock goods, sacks of meal and corn grits. From the house they took a mahogany table, silver flatware and candlesticks, beeswax candles, a painted picture of General Washington off the dining room wall, English china, Tennessee store liquor. They had since decorated the cave up with the plunder. Washington propped in a niche of the wall, candles in silver holders, table set with wedgewood and silver, though many of them had eaten all their lives from table service made entirely of gourd and horn. In some way, though, Stobrod's imagination had not been fully engaged by the Walker raid, and Pangle's banjo had been the whole of his looting. He had taken it from a peg in Walker's tool shed. It was somewhat ugly, lacking as it did the expected symmetry in its round parts. But the head was of catskin and the strings of gut, and it had a fine mellow tone. And he had slapped Walker's face only once in payment for a time long ago, when he had overheard Walker call him a fool as he sat drunk on a log by the road trying in vain to scratch music out of a fiddle. "I've now got mastery of a fiddle," Stobrod had said, after he popped Walker's already red cheek. In retrospect, he had decided the Walker raid worried him. For the first time in his life, he considered the possibility that his actions might be called to account. Back at the cave, Stobrod had given the banjo to the Pangle boy and showed him what little he knew of its working, how to twist the pegs to make a few tunings, how to frail it with thumb and forefinger, sometimes strumming, sometimes grabbing at the strings like a barred owl grabbing at a rabbit. The boy, apparently out of stunning natural talent and a heartfelt desire to provide fitting accompaniment to Stobrod's fiddle, had shown little more difficulty in discovering how to play it than one would in learning to beat a drum. He and Pangle had done not much since the raid but make music. For drink, they had Walker's good liquor, and they ate nothing besides stolen jellies. They slept only when they were too drunk to play, and they had not traveled to the cave mouth frequently enough even to keep track of when day and night occurred. As a result, however, the Pangle boy now knew Stobrod's entire repertoire, and they had become a duo.
When Ruby finally returned, she carried only a small bloody brisket, wrapped in paper, and one jug of cider, for Adams was willing to part with considerably less beef than she had hoped. Ruby stood and looked at her father and the boy and didn't say a word. Her eyes were black in her head, and during her walk her hair had come loose from its tie and spread across her shoulders. She wore a dark green and cream-paneled wool skirt, her gray sweater, and a gray felt man's hat with a tiny cardinal feather in the satin band. She held a paper bundle in her upturned hand and made little up-and-down weighing motions. "Not hardly 4 pounds," she said. She set it and the jug on the ground and went to the house and came back carrying 4 small glasses and a cup of salt, sugar, black pepper, and red pepper, all mixed together. She opened the paper and rubbed the mixture on the meat to case it, and then she buried it in the ashes of the fire and sat on the ground beside Ada. The skirt was long since dingy and would be none the worse for her sitting in the dirt. While the meat cooked, they all sipped at the cider, and then Stobrod took out his fiddle and shook it to hear the rattles inside, and then put it to his chin, bowed a note, and twisted a peg. When he did, the boy sat up and grabbed his instrument and frailed off a series of chiming phrases. Stobrod set off on a minor key tune that was yet somehow sprightly. When he was finished, Ada said, "The plaintive fiddle." Ruby looked at her funny. "My father called it that, always ironically," Ada explained. She went on to say that unlike the common run of preachers who oppose fiddle music as a sin and see the instrument itself as the devil's box, Monroe despised it on aesthetic grounds. His critique was that all fiddle tunes sound just alike and all have strange names. "That's what I like about them," Stavrod said. He tuned some more and then said, "This is one of mine. I call it Drunk Nigger." It was a careening tune, loopy and syncopated, with little work for the left hand, but the bow arm working as frantic as a man fighting off a deer fly from around his head. Stavrod ran through a number more of his compositions. Altogether, they were an odd music, harshly rhythmic, but unsuited, many of them, for dancing, which was the only purpose to which Ruby had ever heard the fiddle addressed. Ada and Ruby sat together and listened, and as they did, Ruby took Ada's hand and held it and absently removed Ada's silver bracelet and slipped it over her own hand, and then after a time returned it to its place. Stavrod changed tunings and called out the names of the pieces before playing them, and gradually Ada and Ruby began to suspect that what they heard collectively formed a sort of autobiography of his war years. Among the tunes were these: Touching the Elephant, Musket Stock Was My Pillow, Ramrod, Six Nights Drunk, Tavern Fight, Don't Sell It, Give It Away, Razor Cut, Ladies of Richmond, Farewell General Lee. To conclude the series, he played one he called Stone Was My Bedstead, a tune made up largely of scraping sounds, chiefly of middling tempo, rhythms of approach and retreat, a great deal of suspense in the relations among its measures. There was no lyric other than a moment when Stavrod threw back his head and chanted the title three times. The Pangle Boy had sense enough to add only subtle little runs and fills, muting the banjo's ring by just softly touching the strings with the meatiest part of thumb and forefinger. Coarse as the song was, Ada found herself moved by it. More so, she believed, than at any opera she had attended from Dock Street to Milan, because Stavrod delivered it with such utter faith in its substance, in its ability to lead one toward a better life, one in which a satisfied mind might one day be attainable. Ada wished there were a way to capture what she was hearing, in the way an ambrotype captures images, so it could be held in reserve for the benefit of a future whose residents might again need access to what it stood for. As the tune drew toward a close, Stavrod jacked back his head so that he seemed to be reviewing the stars, but his eyes were shut. The butt of the fiddle pressed against his heart, and the bow worked in jerky, stuttering little strokes. His mouth flew open at the ultimate moment, but he did not hoot or squeal as Ada expected. Instead, he smiled a deep, long smile of silent delight. He stopped and held the bow in the air at the place where the last upstroke ended, and opened his eyes and looked at the others in the firelight to see what effect his playing had. At that moment, his was a saint's blithesome face, loose and half a smile, with the generosity of his gift, and with a becoming neutrality toward his own abilities, as if he had long since cheerfully submitted to knowing that however well he rendered a piece, he could always imagine doing better. If all the world had a like countenance, war would be only bitter memory. "He's done you some good there," Pangle said to Ada, and then he seemed appalled at having spoken directly to her, and ducked his head, and then looked off into the woods. "We'll do one last one," Stavrod said. He and Pangle put down their instruments and took off their hats, in signification that the next song would be holy, a gospel. Stavrod let off singing, and Pangle followed him. Stavrod had trained the boy's natural gabble into a strained high tenor, and so Pangle chattered partial repetitions of Stavrod's phrases in a style that might, under a whole other system of thinking, have been viewed as comic. Their voices mostly fought against each other until the chorus came around, and then they matched up and found a deep place of concord. The song was about how dark our lives are, how cold and stormy, how void of understanding, and at the end, death. That was all. The song ended somewhat incomplete and blockaded, for contrary to every expectation of the genre, there was no shining path limed out at the last minute to lead one onward with hope. It seemed short one crucial verse. But the chorus harmonies were close and brotherlike, sweet enough in themselves to make partial headway against the song's otherwise gloom. They put their hats back on, and Stavrod held out his glass. Ruby poured him a dram of the cider and stopped, and then he touched the back of her hand with a forefinger. Ada, watching, thought it a tender gesture until she realized it was but to urge the pouring of an extra measure. After Mars had risen red from behind Jonas Ridge and the fire had burned down to a bed of coals, Ruby pronounced the meat done and dug it from the ashes with the pitchfork. The spices had formed a crust around the brisket, and Ruby put it on a stump butt and sliced it thin across the grain with her knife. The inside was pink and running with juice. They ate it with their fingers without benefit of plates, and there was nothing else to the dinner. When they finished, they pulled dry sedge grass from the field edge and scrubbed their hands clean. Stavrod then buttoned the top button of his shirt and grabbed his lapels and pulled at them alternately to square his jacket on him. He took off his hat and wiped the two sprigs of hair back from his temples with his palms and put the hat back on. Ruby watched and then said to no one in particular, "He's about to need somebody to do something for him." Stavrod said, "I want to talk to you, Zal, to ask you something." "Well," she said. "Thing is, I need caring for," Stavrod said. "Has your liquor give out?" Ruby said. "Of that there's a plenty. What it is," he said, "is I'm scared." His fear, he explained, was that the raiding was going to bring the law down on them. A leader had arisen from the outliers, the bearskin man. He was a talker and had given them a common creed, that their fighting in the war had not been pure as they once thought. It had been tainted, because they had fought witless for the big man's ownership of his nigger, the human weakness of hatred driving them on. They were a company of former fools, but they had seen the light. They talked about it all the time, gathering about the fire in seminar. All subsequent warring, they agreed, would be for no other interests but their own. They would not be taken easily and be sent back to the armies. "He's wanting us all to take a blood oath to die like dogs," Stavrod said, "with our teeth in someone's throat. But I didn't quit one army to sign on with another." What Stavrod had decided was that he and Pangl would before long pull out, seek other shelter, leave the warrior band. What he needed was a promise of food, a dry barn loft in bad weather, and maybe now and then a little money, at least until the fighting was over and he could come out free. "Eat roots," Ruby said, "drink muddy water, sleep in a hollow log." "Have you not got more feeling than that for your daddy?" Stavrod said. "I'm just offering instruction in woodcraft. It comes from experience. I've dined on many a route when you were off roundering, slept in worse places than hollow logs." "You know I did my best toward you," Stavrod said. "Times was hard." "Not hard as now," Ruby said, "and don't go telling you did your best. You didn't do a thing at all other than what suited you. And I'll not stand you letting on we're much to each other. I never was anything to you. You came and went, and I could have been there or not when you got back. It didn't much matter one way or the other. If I had died on the mountain, you might have wondered a week or two would I show up, like one coon dog of a many-numbered pack missing when the horn blows and dawn comes. Just that much regret and no more. So don't expect me to go jumping now when you call." "But I'm an old man," Stavrod said. "You told me you're not yet 50. "I feel old," he said. "So do I, for what that's worth," Ruby said. "And there's this. If what's told about Teague is counted as even half true, we have plenty to worry about harboring you. This is not my place. It's not my say. But if it was, I'd say no." They both looked to Ada. She sat with her shawl about her and her hands caught up in the skirts between her knees to keep warm. She could see in their faces that they looked to her as arbiter, maybe for reasons of land ownership or education or culture. And though she did have a certain dominion over the immediate land, she found herself uncomfortable in the role of master. All she could think was that Ruby's father had come back from something like the dead, and that it was a second chance which few are granted. She said, "There is the view that he is your father, and that at some point it becomes your duty to take care of him." "Amen," said Stavrod. Ruby shook her head. "We've got two different ideas of father, then," she said. "I'll tell you something about it from my view. I don't know how old I was, except that I was still cutting teeth. He took off stilling." She turned to Stavrod and said, "Do you even remember? You and Poozler in Cold Mountain, that strike accord?" "I remember," Stavrod said. "We'll tell your part of it," Ruby said. So Stavrod told his story. He and a partner had taken the notion of making liquor for profit, and they went off and lived in bark lean-tos on the mountain. Ruby had seemed to him on her own sufficient. So he had left her for 3 months when she was not yet 8. He and Poozler were not craftsmen of the liquor trade. They ran quick little batches that would hardly fill a teapot, and they found it was too much bother putting washed fire coals in the singlings to filter it, and so nearly every run dripped out either cloudy green or cloudy yellow. But it was strong. They'd not temper it down past about 3/4 straight alcohol. It differed only in minor particulars from the usquebaugh and poteen of their Celt forebears.